There's a lot of crooked stuff going on, but it is interesting. It always seems to go the way of the Democrats. Now in Arizona, all of a sudden, out of the wilderness, they find a lot of votes, and the other candidate is just winning by a hair. What's going on in Florida is a disgrace. Go down and see what happened over the last period of time, 10 years. Take a look at Broward County. Take a look at the total dishonesty of what happened with respect to Broward County. Broward County, just press, Broward County / election. There's a lot of dishonesty.
That was President Donald Trump on Friday, just before taking off on what became kind of an odd trip to France to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the ending of the war to end all wars, World War One. And of course, he was talking there about the tight election recount process in Florida and also Arizona and elsewhere. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Editors Roundtable version of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. Happy Veterans Day to you, my fellow working on Veterans Day co-workers.
Thank you, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Catherine, why are we working on Veterans Day? Just to kind of get this thread out.
Because Reason doesn't have federal holidays off. We don't do what the government tells us to do. We have market holidays off.
Yeah. So what are the market holidays? Isn't every day a holiday on the market?
Sort of, yeah. If you think of it properly. We just don't have these ones that are made up that like Congress added at some point. We have, we have like Christmas, the real holiday.
Okay. Which thankfully is back on the calendar.
Well, part of it is that we get 2 days off at Thanksgiving and 2 days off at Christmas.
That's not, nobody wants the real answer for why we don't have this day off.
And an interrupted real answer from Suderman.
Everybody has 2 days off at Thanksgiving and Christmas. Peter, I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know what HR is telling
Peter's
you.
Peter's previous job was as a
chimney sweep.
In a Dickensian workhouse. Yeah, it was sad, honestly.
That fish restaurant on the Redneck Riviera.
I still have soot and fish grease under my fingernails.
Ew.
Well, speaking of Florida, Peter Suderman. So the president and also the governor of that state, Rick Scott, is making pretty striking allegations of intentional fraud or attempted fraud being committed by incumbent and as of this now recording, losing Senator Bill Nelson. Bill's name is right.
Yeah.
Jeff, something like that. Eric.
Eric Nelson, which with a K.
Strikes me as pretty strong language to describe what's happening there. Since you live in Florida, Peter, is this a fair appraisal? What the hell is happening in Broward County and Palm County? And what do you make of the rhetoric surrounding it?
It's incompetent Democrats and Republicans getting way out over their skis, making claims about voting that
water skis.
Don't have any, possibly even jet skis. That don't have any real reason to, there's no real reason to believe them. And so basically, I mean, Broward County has a long and storied history of incompetence when it comes to complying with election law. And you can credibly accuse them, not just this year, but in many other years, of just kind of failing to comply to get their vote counts in, to supply the information that is required of them, including things like outstanding votes as the election is being tabulated, including it's just some basic information like that, and they don't always do it on time, but there isn't any real reason to believe that this is being done out of some sort of conspiratorial attempt to commit election fraud. And this goes back to the theme that we have heard from Republicans kind of increasingly over the last decade or so, which is that Democrats are out to rig the elections through fraud. Donald Trump is particularly prone to believing that elections are rigged against him. And so he's throwing this out there. And this is just a thing that Republicans believe, is that Democrats are gaming the system, that they are bringing in illegal minority votes and dead people and all of this. And you look at basically every study, and voter fraud does exist very occasionally, but it's extremely small, and there's just no reason to believe that there's a huge influx of illegal immigrant voters who are voting illegally, throwing elections to Democrats, which is basically what Republicans are insinuating here, suggesting that Broward County officials are helping to make that a reality. It's just not true. They're incompetent, and they should be criticized for it. They're not doing a great job of getting their information in on time. But there's no conspiracy here.
Peter, just have you not been convinced, swayed a little bit by Marco Rubio's Twitter feed? He's been going off on these recounts for a while, and the history of skullduggery at Broward County. Where is he off to the extent that you've been following him in particular?
I mean, to the extent that I've been following Rubio, Rubio is overreading the evidence. And some of this incompetence may be of the kind of, let's not call it entirely intentional, but of the convenient kind. But there is not a wide-ranging conspiracy to rig the vote against Republicans. There is perhaps a kind of cluster duck of bad counting that someone hopes perhaps in the end the messiness will resolve in a way that provides Democrats with a path to a legitimate victory. It doesn't actually look like that's going to happen. What we're looking at here is a bunch of late votes coming in, a bunch of uncounted votes, Democrats perhaps looking for more votes that they hope will weigh things to their side, not trying to come up with tens of thousands of fake votes. And that is what Trump and the rest of people, the Republicans here are insinuating, is that Democrats are making a concerted effort to come up with tens of thousands of fake votes to swing the election to their way. And that's not what's happening.
A lot of language from the likes of Rick Scott saying and Donald Trump saying that Democrats are actively trying to steal the election here in Florida. They also mention Arizona, where all the Republicans that I have seen on the ground or who have a history of being Republicans counting votes on the ground say, hey, look, our process here is fine. They're trying to stir up. And this includes Martha McSally, the Republican candidate who looks like she's probably going to lose now. And I should point out hastily that the Republicans in Florida look like they're going to win. So it's kind of strange. But stacking up the, hey, they're trying to steal the election with the, hey, there's chicanery happening in Arizona when there really doesn't seem like that there's any, along with Trump's post November 2016 claim that there were between 3 and 5 million illegal immigrant votes that somehow went to Hillary Clinton and thus jeopardized warped his popular vote count. Doesn't it seem like we're in a kind of a new place in terms of top down kind of reckless accusations of vote stealing?
I don't know. I'm old enough to remember the 2000 election. And things got pretty reckless around that vote counting process, too. I mean, I think it's bad for everyone to immediately jump to full-fledged allegations of conspiracy, which is what happened. I mean, on election night,
everyone, like, including not just everyone led by the president of the United States, led by the president.
Yeah. And this was happening on election night, like, before there was even time to have been vote counting fraud. Like, it was a pre-programmed talking point. It was already built in, and we saw it in 2016 too. But when the stakes get very high, and when there are legitimate failings on the part of the election apparatus, Florida, then I think this is a natural consequence. I mean, you don't have to take it all the way to tens of thousands of, made up votes. And, I'm looking at Marco Rubio's Twitter feed right now, and there are like 47 pictures of this one box of provisional ballots. Well, it says provisional ballot box on the outside. I think it turned out to contain office supplies. It's a little unclear.
Pencils. It's like those money bags in
like if you put
cartoons.
A big dollar sign on the outside, then they become bags of money. Yeah. So, I think I don't know. I think that when the stakes are high, people start to get real persnickety about details, and Florida consistently fails in the details. And yes, it's bad that the president is encouraging this.
But
isn't, in 2000,
admit,
this happened too.
But can you admit it is unprecedented that the president of the United States, first off, still hasn't fully accepted the election that made him president?
Yeah,
much
the
less,
Pennsylvania
and now
stuff.
He is still like... He's like, oh, they're cheating and they're lying. And Florida, yeah, there's like a documented history of incompetence there, as Peter was talking about, and possible malfeasance. In Arizona, there's not. And it's kind of screwed up that the, you know, the president of all people is leading the charge without any basis in this. Because like in Arizona, he tweeted out, you know, the signatures are different between what people signed on their ballot versus what they signed on their registration card. And I don't know about the rest of you. I didn't even realize I was ahead of the curve when I just started like basically drawing a line for my signature a couple of years ago, which now everybody says you should do because of, you know, we're signing everything. But it's screwed up.
You're just visually depicting your heartbeat.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. My heartbeat at a near future date. But
I mean, there are reports that McSally has actually received pushback and pressure from the White House to be more aggressive about claiming fraud in Arizona. And McSally's like, these are just late votes. This is totally normal. This is how things work.
And there is also, I think there's another point here, which is that as there's sort of faster churn of information encouraged by the president, people are apt to read things that are basically normal as abnormal. And it's always true that after elections, there's lots of leftover votes to count and there's lots of details to sort out and there's lots of things to wrap up. And when elections aren't close, we just don't pay attention to that. And mostly elections aren't close, thanks to the garbage redistricting and gerrymandering process that we have in the United States, especially high stakes elections at the federal level. But in Florida, elections are always close. That's how Florida is now. All the elections every day are close.
Florida could have like a babies and puppies on the one side and like murder squads.
Literally Satan on the other side.
I mean, Satan actually is pretty popular in Florida, but like murder squads aren't. But it would still be 50.5, 49.5.
But, you know, maybe that's the big takeaway from a libertarian perspective is that, you know, it is kind of great that like, you know, the two parties, the duopoly, has a complete, you know, they have total control over every election on every level, including, you know, when you look at like, you know, ballots in places like New York State where you have to go and turn a page and then like, you know, look at a post-it on the back of the electronic, vote ballot in New York to find Larry Sharp, the Libertarian candidate, or anybody who's not a major party player. They still can't. You know, they can't win. Like we're splitting hairs to find out which, you know, turd sandwich or, you know, giant douche is going to be the senator or the governor of Florida. And that's kind of a big takeaway.
Adding to that, Steve Kornacki, who is always great to follow during elections and after elections, he's been peering into the Broward County stuff. There is a legitimate undervote in Broward County compared to all 66 other Florida counties of people who didn't vote for Senate who did vote for governor. I think I have that in the correct order. Everywhere else, it's pretty much the same, but somehow it's not in Broward. And his theory is that they designed a bad ballot. Yes, the same state that brought you the butterfly ballot in which people who clearly intended to vote for Al Gore ended up disproportionately voting for Pat Buchanan compared to their numbers, something that Pat Buchanan himself has gleefully acknowledged over the years. It is possible that the margin is going to be measurable or close. The margin for victory, the assumed victory for Rick Scott, is going to be measurable in terms of bad ballot design in Broward County, which is a super Democratic county where you would think and that they would try to twist the knobs in that direction. Nick, where does this all play, this type of unusual or overheated kind of a conversation play into your low trust and decreasingly low trust thesis of how Americans look and feel and act about their each other and also their government.
Well, I mean, it fuels the idea that nothing can be trusted. I mean, like, you know, I mean, votes and this, I mean, this was the huge takeaway. And, you know, and really, I don't know that we've gotten over it in a weird way. As much as 9/11 is the kind of signature event of the 21st century, in many ways for America, it was the 2000 election. And the fact that that was ultimately decided by a couple of thousand votes, every retabulation, you know, found that George Bush won, et cetera, and all of that kind of stuff. So there isn't a question of that. But when you have a country that at that point we had 300 million people, where the election is coming down to a few thousand votes, it's effectively, you know, it's a dead heat. And God, like, is there a stronger metaphor for like where we are politically, where we are stuck with these fucking two parties that ultimately don't distinguish themselves from one another, as much as they have sorted completely into a liberal and a conservative party by rhetoric? They don't actually distinguish themselves by how they govern. And it's, you know, and you have to look and I think this isn't like libertarian camp. This isn't just a talking point. When you look at the way Bush and the Republicans governed for the first 6 years of his presidency, and you look at the way that Obama and the Democrats governed, if you took the labels off, it would be hard to really say they were different. Like, one wanted to expand Medicare and did. One wanted to expand health, government paid for health care and did. They both spied massively on people. They both initiated foreign wars or extended them or increased them in weird ways. Neither of them is interested in like seriously coming up with a politics for the 21st century. And I think that's where we are. And that's, you know, unfortunately, the low trust thesis is simply that as people begin to trust each other less and trust government less, they call for more government, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's how people respond. And we're kind of in that now where, you know, I was just reading earlier today about how, you know, the debt is really out of control. I mean, like, we all know this. We talk about this incessantly, but we have $20 trillion in debt and the interest rates are going up. And by 2020, we're going to be paying more in interest on the debt, according to the Wall Street Journal, than we are for our military, which is like $700 billion a year. So that's it. Like, it's all entitlement spending and interest on the debt from here on out, basically, because we can't really raise more money via taxes than we've been doing for the past 20 years.
I wonder, Peter, listening to Nick's recapitulation of the 21st century, I wonder a couple of things. One, if the amount of new debt, if I'm not mistaken, went from $5 trillion to $10 trillion under Bush, $10 trillion to $20 trillion under Obama, and granted, this, you know, obviously this is with Congresses and whatever, but this is during their presidencies. It's like from 20 to 21.5 so far under Trump. But the unified government aspect of that. So that's what, $16.5 trillion in new debt since the Bush-Gore election. I wonder, what percentage of that is in unified government periods of time between all of that. And that's just more of a rhetorical wonder. You can, if you've been doing the calculation, you can share it with us. But since you just gave a talk at Reason Weekend about how screwed we are on this, if you could just give us a quick mini share of the death porn that you see looking at the Congressional Budget Office and the debt monster that's going to eat us all.
So the big legislative initiatives, the expensive ones, I don't know the percentage, but the expensive legislative initiatives basically all came during periods of unified government. The expensive ones and the ones that raised the deficit, you can say maybe arguably the tax law last year was not expensive, but it certainly was a big hit to the deficit.
Let me actually just chime in here because I remembered that we had a Veronique Durugy and Matt Mitchell article about this a while back, and I will share this in the associated links from the podcast. But it is true what Peter says that when we have a united government, average annual increase in spending is 4.7%, and we have divided government, average annual increase in spending is 2.5%. That's where we live. Notable united government big spenders include JFK, Johnson, and Obama.
And look, so with the congressional budget, so, you asked about
hold
the
on,
congressional
hold on,
budget.
Hold on, hold on, hold on, Catherine. I'm sorry. So the Vero thing was for all modern history, not just the 21st century, because I have a feeling that the gap would be much wider if it's just in the last 18 years.
The chart I'm looking at goes back to Eisenhower.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, it's the difference between Clinton under divided government, W under united government, W under divided government, and Obama is very, very striking.
Okay, go on, Peter. Sorry.
I mean, you asked about the Congressional Budget Office, and every couple of months they release yet another report that's basically just like, you know, from a fiscal perspective, we're probably kind of screwed, and we're especially screwed if you look in the kind of medium to long term, the long term budget outlook. The first, if you go to the page, before you even get to the report, you get like a one sentence summary that sort of sets up what the rest of this whole big report is about. And it just says, if current laws remain generally unchanged, CBO projects federal budget deficits and debt would increase over the next 30 years, reaching the highest level of debt relative to GDP, that's the economy, in the nation's history by far. And then if you read a little bit further into the report, just the summary, this is just sort of the way they start, the way they frame everything else they're about to tell you. At 78% of gross domestic product, federal debt held by the public is now at its highest level since shortly after World War II. If current laws remain generally unchanged, CBO projects growing budget deficits would boost that debt sharply over the next 30 years. It would approach 100% of GDP by the end of the next decade and 152% by 2048. That amount would be the highest in the nation's history by far. Moreover, if lawmakers change current law to maintain certain policies now in place, preventing a significant increase in individual income taxes in 2026, for example. And I'll just pause here to say every single Republican has said they want to do that. The result would be even larger increases in debt. The prospect of large and growing federal debt poses substantial risks for the nation and presents policymakers with significant challenges. Yeah. So that's like what they release every couple of months, and they've been releasing this, some version of this, in kind of increasingly apocalyptic budget outlook, sort of, you know, fiscal projections, basically for the last decade. And
I like
at this point, there's not even any party that's talking about it.
I like the tethering to World War II era debt, to post-World War II era debt, because I think that's something that people can understand, even if they're not anything like budget nerds, like to understand, like, okay, think about if, for instance, we had just come off of a second global war in which the entire economy had been turned to wartime production and it had been largely debt funded. Okay, this is worse.
Yeah, like, and that's so there a good was, way to say you know, it. There was a they released a bunch of reports like this in the aftermath of the Great Recession and the stimulus bill. And there was an economic argument. I'm not saying it's a good one. It's one that I argued against repeatedly in the pages and pixels of Reason magazine. But there was an economic argument. There is a strain of kind of mainstream economic thinking that says, well, look, after a recession, what you want to do is basically sort of fill in the economic output gap with stimulus spending. There is no economic argument at all for the kind of deficit spending. We're basically doing stimulus through tax cuts, which, to be fair, you know, George W. Bush did too, although not
to this extent. He did in 2008, yeah.
But we are doing stimulus through tax cuts by deficit funding the tax reductions in the tax law that was passed at the end of last year. And there is no argument for that at all. There's nobody who thinks, oh, this is a pretty good idea and this is basically working, aside from, you know, the White House, it's Flax, Chills, and Larry Kudlow.
We're also doing defense stimulus, Peter. I mean, we're jacking up military spending right now, and some of the justification from it by both the president but also individual senators and Congress critters is that, oh, this is good. This is how you create long-lasting jobs here. Catherine, when we think about the virtues of divided governments on pocketbook issues, this generally assumes that The opposition party, once it controls the House, let's say, which is what we're going to see here, is going to provide some kind of restraint, or at least use the annual ritual of the Cromnibus bill passed on December 27th to inflict some kind of restraint on what the president wants to do. Do you see in the Democratic coalition that is assembling right now, anything like the mechanism or the stated aims, philosophy of a party that might be inclined to restrain some of the profligate ways of the Trump administration and the governing Republicans?
There's certainly nothing ideological or philosophical in the platforms of the incoming Democrats that would suggest that. But I think the at least one theory of the mechanism whereby divided government results in lower annual increases in spending is just that people get busy with other stuff. And it certainly is true that we have seen a lot of explicit mention that we are about to enter a all investigations, all the time era of congressional behavior, that we are about to enter just a fully oppositional relationship between the Senate and the House, at the very least.
I would say even more between the House and the White House.
Right, well, certainly for between the House and the White House, but also between the Senate and the House, which may actually be the thing that slows congressional behavior and spending more. And I think there's just going to be a huge amount of both psychic energy and actual just like raw in-session days devoted to grandstanding and obstructionism in a way that is, you know, bad for the nation, maybe broadly, but will probably have the result of just like fewer dollars will flow outward.
So although, I want to make, I think that that's not totally wrong, but I just want to make a small counter argument to that, which is that if Republicans had maintained power in the House, what was their agenda? Their agenda was maybe let's do some more tax cuts. And they passed that tax cuts 2.0 thing. And President Trump said, oh, there's this middle class tax cut coming that was totally fake and made up on the spot, as far as anybody can tell, on the campaign trail. There was no agenda. Like, if Republicans had maintained the House, it would have been just the same, but without the investigations.
Maybe. But what? I mean, this is also the kind of thing where once you have power, you use it in non-intentional ways, I guess. So like, I can easily imagine a scenario in which the Republicans retained control of the House in which like military spending just gets even bigger, just kind of accidentally while they're doing their normal business. Like that kind of thing is what happens in unified government, which doesn't casually, semi-intentionally happen in divided government.
Here, I think the more chilling kind of, and it's building both on what Catherine and Peter are saying, Matt, is what's really chilling is that, first off, the Republican Party no longer even has a rhetoric of restraining spending. They don't care about spending. You know, they've made that clear. They certainly don't want to pay for spending through increasing taxes, which is ultimately, you know, it's like if the government spends money, somebody's got to pay for it either through, you know, reduced benefits down the road, higher taxes now, or inflation in between, or some combination of the three. The Republican Party doesn't even talk about that anymore. It's not clear what they believe in. The Democratic Party has never, you know, and they've elected at least a handful of people who may never be heard from again. But
they believe in voter fraud and stopping the immigrants from crossing the border.
Yeah, you know, that migrant caravan is really, you know, the 100 people who make it through Mexico's, you know, desert or 1,000 miles of Mexico are going to bankrupt the country. But
and
when they get here,
the troops on the border are going to cost us $200 million.
But when they get here, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and people like her, and again, they may never be heard from again. It might be the smartest thing in the world to take all the Democratic socialists in America and put them in Congress, where they may never be heard from again. But they are literally saying, like, no, Medicare for all and free college for all and everything. And when they're asked, how do you pay for it? They're just like, oh, you just pay for it. All of that is going on, like where there is no party of fiscal restraint anymore, even rhetorically. And on top of it, all of the spending now is mandatory, or what's considered mandatory versus discretionary, which is a fake terminology, but it's all on autopilot. And I only started writing about budget stuff about 15 years ago. And when I did, and this was with, I wrote a lot, I co-authored a lot with Veronique DeRougie, our columnist who works at the Mercatus Center. You could say 15 years ago, kind of credibly, that federal spending is half discretionary and half mandatory. It is no longer that. And it's getting more and more like 2/3, 75% increasingly where it's on autopilot, because it is entitlement spending, which goes up whether or not Congress passes any new law or does anything. They don't have to be in session for one day. Entitlement spending will go up automatically. And then there's stuff like interest on the debt, which is going up because interest rates are going up. So we're screwed on this. Like, nobody is talking about this. And this is the underlying grammar of everything in America. Of the economy. If the government debt gets so bad that people start losing faith in the economy, they lose faith in, like, why do you work for tomorrow? Because you're going to get screwed today and you're going to get screwed even more tomorrow. It's a bad, bad, big, bad thing. And we're not talking about it. Instead, we're talking about, like, you know, interns and microphones in the White House and, you know, voter fraud that it seems to be working in the Republicans' favor. But that's what's dominating the news.
The Congressional Budget Office occasionally puts a paragraph or two in these reports, and sometimes does independent reports as well, sort of outlining options for reducing the debt and talking about how, just, you know, sort of showing you what it would take to significantly reduce the debt and deficits. And they basically say that to get out of the weeds, you have three options. One, you can more or less eliminate all discretionary spending, like all of it, like basically leave the government entirely as entitlements and defense spending and nothing else. Two, you can do major entitlement reform, particularly to healthcare, and really focused on Medicare, which, as I have said repeatedly, the problem is Medicare, the problem is Medicare, the problem is Medicare. Or you can really significantly raise taxes. Possibly you can do some combination of those things, but those are basically the options. And you may notice that there is not a party that is, let's radically reduce spending on Medicare through a reform. There's not a party that's saying we should get rid of all discretionary spending, nor is there a party saying we should radically increase taxes on basically everyone, including
the middle class. I mean, the first two are kind of the LP, right?
Fine.
No, you're. I think you're right,
but
Catherine.
So neither of the parties that are consistently winning a lot of elections.
There you go.
And like, to make it even worse, the whole idea that you could raise taxes. I mean, we've tried that, and when you go back to, you know, 1945 or 1950 going forward, there have been moments where federal revenue, like, top 20% of GDP for like a year or two, including as late as the late 90s or early 2000s under Bill Clinton. There was a boom, and he also cut taxes in a certain way. But it's never sustainable. And, like, you're never going to be able to reliably get more than 17, 18, maybe 19% of GDP. That's the limit if we're going to pay for government in any given year. It's got to come in.
So I will push back a little bit on that. I think that's true if we maintain roughly the current tax system. If we moved over to a VAT, to a value-added tax, which is basically a national sales tax, which is much harder to evade and sort of creates incentives built in for everyone to collect the revenue along the way. And this is how a lot of the European countries do it. If we moved over to a VAT and raised income taxes on the middle class, I think that this might work. But even Democrats are saying, well, I don't want
Nobody's
the middle class to have to pay
that,
more
yeah.
taxes, right?
I mean, and already we're in a lopsided, I mean, the VAT, one of the things that is spectacular about it is actually that it means everybody pays. And in Europe, the taxation levels are higher in general, but it's, you know, but poor people
get more
services.
But in particular, they're higher on middle income earners. If you go to the lower
income
countries,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You see that the marginal tax rates for incomes above, you know, relatively sort of typical median household type incomes, you know, incomes in the $60,000 range, the tax rates end up being 50% or so effectively
here is, but
after
here's,
you hit about
$60,000. Here's the larger, like, we shouldn't, I don't think we should think about this as like a technical discussion of like, how do you pay for the government we have now?
Well, it's more, nobody is thinking about it as a technical discussion.
Yeah, no, but
and
I'm saying
that's
like,
a big problem.
How much of this government that we have now, that if you had to pay for it, you would be like, no freaking way. I don't want that. Like, you know, it's I mean, years ago, I wrote a thing about like government by Groupon, where it was like there were periods during Bush and Obama where we were borrowing almost 40 cents a dollar of, you know, of what we were spending. And, you know, it's one thing if you get something for 60 cents on the dollar or 70 cents on the dollar, you might be like, yeah, I'll take an extra one. But it's like if you're paying a dollar, you'd be like, no freaking way. And this is actually at the state level. What's interesting is that at various points, because state governments and local governments can't mint money the way that the government does, when they occasionally have these discussions where they say, look, this is the amount of money we have to spend. What are we going to spend it on? You have very different political conversations. And I think that is the turn in the 21st century that we have not been able to make yet. Because entitlement spending is based on a kind of like going back to Bismarck. It's based on a way of co-opting people who everybody thinks they're going to get more out of the system than they put in. And it just doesn't work anymore.
Everyone is perfectly happy to have their children and grandchildren pay for everything they want right now. Like that's what we've learned.
But also
in the 21st
people just
century.
Have a wild misconception about how Medicare and Social Security work because of the way that they're taxed. People assume that they are basically paying for their own benefits and that they are being taxed, that money is being put away and saved. That's not what's happening. As we have said, as we all know, it's an intergenerational transfer program. The money that is coming out of my paycheck right now is paying for my parents, for other people's grandparents' benefits. It goes directly from young workers to retirees. It is not. And then when you retire, you get a lot more out of it than you put in, which, okay, that's great, except for the fact that a program in which everybody puts in a quarter to a third of what they get out is a program that runs huge deficits. Medicare alone has $37 trillion, $37 trillion worth of unfunded liabilities in the next 75 years. That's on top of our federal debt.
I think people can hold both of those ideas in their mind, though. I think people hold both the idea, I paid in and now what I'm getting out is fair, even though that's not true. And they can also hold in their mind, hey, the government broadly is spending more than it's taking in. That's why we have debt. That's why we have deficits. And you know what? Whatever. We'll figure it out later on when the bill comes due. And that mirrors people's household budgeting.
But if you poll people, speaking, they tell you what they think we're spending too much on, and it's foreign aid, which is about 1% or less of the federal budget.
I would just like to add to the this conversation, another consideration. Nick alluded to state and local governments having different kind of ways to play hide the ball on budgets. More difficult. They're supposed to balance the budget at the end. Well, what happened the last time suddenly the economy went bad? What happened is all the states who had spent the prior 7 to 8 years of comparatively good times had effectively doubled their budgets. We did a piece with Arnold Schwarzenegger's grim face on it called Failed States back in 2008, I believe, that measured this out pretty great, sort of talking about the growth of state budgets compared to population increase and inflation increase. And if they had stowed away their money for a rainy day and just limited their increases to that, they would have had money for a rainy day, as would have had the federal government. So what happened then is that Barack Obama got elected, and so did Democrats. And for 2 years, they ran Washington. They then engaged in a huge bailout of state governments. Fast forward to, I don't know, this morning, President Trump is talking smack about Puerto Rico, saying that he wants to somehow suspend or stop federal disaster relief aid to Puerto Rico because he suspects, although not providing any evidence for it, that they are using that to pay off their debts, which are very considerable. Puerto Rico has been mismanaged for a long time, in part because of federal minimum wage policies and other things, and the Jones Act. So Trump says this about a disfavored, in his point of view, political bloc known as Puerto Rico. He also, California right now is just burning to the ground. There's been more than 30 people killed there. There's going to be a lot more, I think. I fret before it's all over. And the president has mentioned, like straight out of the gate, it's all because of, you know, these damn liberals don't know how to manage forestries, and maybe we need to cut off federal aid there. There is not going to be, I would predict, a similar bailout of the states when the next time the recession happens. And the thing is, that's going to happen soon. We've had 9 years, more or less, of uninterrupted economic growth. It's been goosed up a little bit more in recent months and years. We've had 9 years, more or less, of uninterrupted, even greater stock market growth, which has been sort of flat and turbulent since Trump first announced his tariffs on March 1st of this year. There's going to be a moment when the dishes come down to the ground and break, and there's not going to be that bailout. So that future, which seems so far off to everybody right now, is going to happen all at once. And the amount of political conflict that's baked into it is, I think it's kind of unfathomable, simply because it's like childbirth, Catherine. You wipe it from your memory after the unpleasant thing happens, so that you can convince yourself that it's worth doing again. Yeah. I think that we're going through that as a country.
That,
right
by
now,
the way, is the ultimate mansplaining.
No, he's right, though. You know what? Yeah. He's just saying amen to the chorus of the ladies. I think it's okay. Yeah, no, that's totally true. And I think you're completely right about the different dynamics for state bailouts going forward. I just want to come back, though, to the Puerto Rico story for a second, because it's such a great example of how policy is and isn't made in this administration. There's a Wall Street Journal article. Trump reads it. Misreads it by many accounts, I think fairly characterizes misreading it, believes that Puerto Rico is taking the federal emergency dollars and paying off debt, therefore wants to end emergency funding to Puerto Rico. Now, but also just declares that plan in a tweet. There's no subsequent policymaking. There's no proposals written. Like, it won't happen. So that's like basically all of the Trump administration, I would say, in a pretty tidy little pod right there. And while I am not an expert in these sorts of things, it also strikes me as like not the most irresponsible thing to do with an influx of money if your economy is currently being crippled by debt to pay off some of that debt. Like, that's not even what's happening. But if it were, it's not clear to me that that's how
Trump
you would respond.
Objectively hates doing things in ways that don't maximize debt or deficits.
He's objectively pro-debt.
No, he's literally declared himself the king of debt. And there's a pretty good reporting that when he was discussing an infrastructure bill that never happened last year, Gary Cohn, at that time, one of his economic advisors, the rest of his team wanted him to leverage federal money in order to pay for $1 trillion worth of infrastructure spending. There was some good and some bad about that plan. We won't get into the details right now, but Trump was like, no, all I want to do is pay for this thing entirely using federal debt. That is my plan.
Right. Oh, you know what I should add in my fable of how, controversies in lawmaking work under Trump, I should add, of course, that the final stage of this process will be Democrats will then make a big show about wanting to send money to those poor Puerto Ricans who are just suffering, and then demagogue the issue going forward as Trump wants Puerto Ricans to starve to death.
I think you guys are mistaking Trump for a cause rather than an effect. And, you know, Matt, when it comes to the federal government bailing out the states or pushing money to the states, that's going to be decided by Congress, you know, which does have the budget making power and, you know, ultimately the power of the purse and all of that kind of stuff. And there is no way that, like, if there is a giant slump, because it's going to hit California, but it's also going to hit Texas and it's going to hit Florida and it's going to hit every other state, and every member of Congress and every senator and every governor is going to be, you know, coming with their hands out. And I think this is part of the problem, is that, like, we have not had an honest accounting for decades, really, but certainly you know, after the financial crisis, and again, I mean, you know, this was something, and Matt, when you were editing the magazine, you did a ton of stories about this, which were spot on, where, you know, the weird thing about like the 2008 campaign, which if memory serves, was between Obama and McCain. McCain suspended his campaign to come back to vote for all of the terrible, you know, bailout bills that were going through Congress. And, you know, Obama just took, he took like the local rather than the express, because they were totally, you know, they were on the same train. I mean, like, of course, you know, of course we're going to bail everybody out. We're, of course. And there isn't that time. Like, there's just nobody. And maybe this is just the way that governments go. I don't know. You know, I mean, what's odd about that moment after World War II, and it did cause Harry Truman, you know, real problems after 48, but like they cut spending, you know, the, you know, and again, we did stories about this. We did 3D videos about the ways in which both the US and other countries cut spending, you know, very quickly, very fast, overnight, essentially, or the, you know, the figurative equivalent, and ended up flourishing economically in the 90s. I mean, Canada did it and Sweden did it and a bunch of other countries. We did it. And, you know, when Catherine was early on talking about, you know, what we were doing during World War II and how the economy was completely geared towards, you know, to war making. Everything was rationed. And Russ Roberts, the, you know, econ talk economist, you know, talks a lot about when people say, oh, stimulus spending, you know, got us out of, you know, World War II got us out of the Depression. He was like, no, you know, we weren't rich during World War II. We were borrowing a lot and everything was rationed. And it only, we became wealthy after the government receded really from plain view and decontrolled the economy. You know, we need something like that. And it's really hard to do it short of, you know, some kind of economic crisis that makes it impossible. Because like what we've been seeing is now we're, you know, we have more debt. We've been on this spending spree and we have nothing to show for it. We don't even have like fancy tanks or anything.
That's the amazing thing. I mean, I recall when Barack Obama was thumping the tub for various infrastructure spending boomlets, some of which was, there was a substantial sum in the stimulus package that was supposed to be for infrastructure. He would tell a shaggy dog story about how we used to build the Golden Gate Bridge. Now we don't build the Golden Gate Bridge anymore. Even though the Golden Gate Bridge was totally not built by the federal government. And there's plenty of interesting backstory to all of that. But there is something underlying all that that is true and is perennially, even, you know, month by month, unreflected on. Why is everything so expensive to do from a government point of view and also doesn't work? You know, we almost had to push this podcast back 30 minutes just because the damn subway here in New York is starting to work almost as bad as the subway in Washington, D.C., which, Catherine, do you have a rule that no staffer can now take the subway? Because that would seem like a prudent a way going forward.
Have told staffers that they can stay home, like, or work primarily at home when the subway station near their house is under renovation, because it becomes such a nightmare to get in. Which is, I mean, that is like a, you know, you start to feel a smidge like you're living in an Ayn Rand novel. I try to avoid that that sense.
They're under renovation like half the time, and it's like, you know, 20% of the stations will be under renovation for 6 months at a time, and it's terrible. There are fireballs. There's really the thing that you need to
the fireballs in the subway.
The thing that you need
thing.
To understand about the Washington D.C. metro system is that there are videos of giant fireballs sweeping through the train stations and across the platforms, and you're just like, what? How can this be allowed?
I do want to note very quickly. In the sort of reorganizing of the government post-World War II, there's this great factoid, which is that, you know, because government is the way it is, they were reluctant to relinquish total control of the economy, right? Like, once you have it, it seems kind of fun. It's like, maybe let's, you know, so there was the War Production Board, the War Labor Board, the Office of Civilian Supply, and the Office of Price Administration. And they were like, maybe we should just keep those. And it was, you know, it was the 40s. There was some vogue for centrally controlled economies at that point. And the thing that actually, a sort of historical tidbit, the thing that wound up encouraging decontrol was that in the 1946 election, Republicans took a majority in the House for the first time since 1930, which caused the price administrator to remove all price controls in the 5 days after the election rather than leave them in the hands of the other party. So there's a great example of divided government reducing the size and scope of
the state. It's also, you know, it's between Truman and, you know, and then Eisenhower. Eisenhower left office with a budget surplus, or with at least a primary balance in the budget of spending and taxes. And, you know, Eisenhower was a failed president on many fronts, but in many ways he was also a kind of spectacular, and obviously talking about the military industrial complex on his way out, but also like insisting on basic budgeting and the idea that the government should not be that big a thing is kind of amazing. And like, weirdly, now that libertarian rhetoric has won, like everybody grants, even when they're making the case for more government, they're willing to say, well, you know, and there's going to be a lot of waste and fraud and abuse of this, but we still need to do it anyway. I mean, the one thing, oddly, I think like the libertarian argument that the government is bad at what it does has won, but it doesn't preclude us from saying, and the government should be doing more, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. It's a very confusing situation.
I mean, and this comes out just to add some timeliness to it. I think there was a big NBC News report today about the VA bungling, not sending out promised benefits to veterans in terms of, I think, housing vouchers and whatnot. So people haven't been receiving it for 4 to 5 months out of the time, impacting their lives. People are going homeless as a result, or couch surfing, or whatever. And it's because they don't know how to, the VA doesn't know how to do an IT upgrade. And I just always wonder in these circumstances, particularly with the VA, which is such a like poignant and heartbreaking, heartrending personal effect on people that we have made promises to, that maybe that's a time for reflection of when you create this gigantic government bureaucracy, they don't work too good. And this is partly as a result of Donald Trump passing the new GI Bill Act, or the Congress passing and him ratifying in 2017, which promises ever new benefits, but they didn't fix their IT as part of it. People don't make the direct connection to how government works badly and draw the conclusions from
that you would expect. One of the, I think, you know, strongest rhetorical arguments against Medicare for All is the idea, like, you know, and seniors love Medicare because they're getting discount health care, you know, at quite a discount, and nobody turns them down. But it's like, if it's VA, you know, if it's veterans health care for all, it suddenly looks a lot shittier because they get bad health care ultimately. But it's free.
I was at a Libertarian Party convention in Massachusetts in Springfield about a month ago. And it was pretty cool because we convened a panel discussion that I moderated among, I think, a half a dozen veterans who are members of the Libertarian Party, which is not the immediate caricature that comes to mind of your modal member of the party. And these guys were kind of less ideological on some level, the median one, than you might see on the average libertarian, or at least have some complicated real world experience that kind of cuts in different ways. But man, when you say, so how's your experience with the VA going? I mean, just the eruption in kind of groans and head shaking and fury. It's amazing. And it's not, and it didn't strike me as a particularly ideological response, rather than this is the lived in reality that I have to deal with. And I do everything I can to get the hell out and away from the strictures of that reality and to find some choice elsewhere. Well, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that I was kind of hoping that we would talk about, but I'm fine with the conversation just flowing.
Can we do a lightning round, Matt Welch?
Lightning round. Okay. Lightning round. Anything else in the news that has happened since the last time we talked 72 hours ago that you think is worth commenting on? I'll start with Nick.
No, I've got nothing.
See, don't ask for the lightning
round. Why did you ask for a lightning round?
Unless you're ready to bring the thunder.
I thought Matt had a series of trenchant topics that we should be discussing.
I want to go right to what are you consuming. That's my favorite part.
Then let's start with what are you consuming. Catherine?
So I am consuming a thing that Jeff Bezos tells everyone to consume, and so he can't possibly be wrong, which is a 1975 television interview between Isaac Asimov and the physicist Gerard O'Neill.
Yes!
Which describes the reasons that humanity needs to get the heck off of the surface of this messy, messy planet. And it's basically what Bezos refers to when people say, like, dude, why do you have a space company? Which is a totally legit question for someone who runs a large bookstore. And this is his answer. And it's 30 minutes. And it is the most classic 1970s television. Like, everyone's voice is like a weird made-up accent. There are a lot of turtlenecks involved. And you should watch every single minute of it.
What's the short answer? Like, why do we need to get off the planet?
The reason that it's great is because it's 1975 television and there isn't a short answer. There is no short answer. I mean, it's essentially, it's like the insurance program argument. It's like
a podcast.
We need to keep the breadbasket intact. We need to keep Earth as essentially like a place to regenerate from and return to, but we should be doing our general business as humanity elsewhere. And, you know, it's driven out of the energy crisis and a lot of other things that are specific to the 70s, but it's also just like glorious and eternally relevant. So
You had me at turtlenecks. Speaking of which, Nick.
Now, you know, I can't wear turtle. Even mock turtlenecks are too constraining for this libertarian, Matt Welch, a refugee from the 70s. I am reading. I'm doing a deep dive into Tao Lin's oeuvre. He's a novelist who's probably best known for the novel that came out a few years ago called Taipei. He's Taiwanese American, but his most recent book is The Trip, and it's about his experiences with psychedelics and also his life being transformed by the work of Terence McKenna, the great kind of one of the great gurus of psychedelics and hallucinogens. His work is fascinating. It's a mix of like beatnik literature really fused by psychedelic drugs and you know, this quest for why are we here and what happens if you take a lot of drugs and you don't necessarily feel better about the universe. You just feel like you're more out in the universe. He's an incredible writer.
Or in my case, what happens when you take very few drugs and you feel a lot worse. Peter, what have you been consuming?
I watched Overlord, which is a World War II era Nazi zombie thriller from the writer and director of Shattered Glass.
I feel like, have you not already talked about this, or is it just that every single one of your recommendations sounds like that?
Well, it is a case for why the video game Wolfenstein, which I have talked about, which is a video game franchise that's been going on since the early 90s.
Yeah.
But it's still thriving. It's actually quite a good sort of reboot this console generation. And it's really, the movie is only okay. It's kind of disappointing in some ways. It's functional. But it really makes me wish that John Carpenter had made it in the 1980s. It would have been a lot better. And it also makes me long to see a Wolfenstein movie in which B.J. Blazkowicz uses a ray gun to blast the flesh off of evil Nazis.
Character's name is B.J. Blazkowicz?
Sure is.
Wow.
Well, makes Peter, me long is, to see that as a movie.
What is the hook of, like, you know, we love Nazis in popular culture and we love zombies. Why are zombie Nazis such a hook?
Well, I mean, it's not quite zombies in the Walking Dead sense. It's zombies in the Nazi scientist was developing a serum to bring people back from the dead in order to create undead super soldiers that could serve in a thousand-year Reich.
Reanimated, maybe.
Yes.
Not just reanimated.
Reanimated with, like, some bone spikes coming out of their back, the ability to throw you through walls, perhaps the ability to have their skulls half-crushed and still pick you up and put you on a meat hook. You know, that sort of thing.
So mine is a cautionary tale out there, especially for parents and Christmas overindulgers. There's a new movie out by Lassie Hallström, of all people, called like The Nutcracker and the Fourth Realm or some damn shit.
Or some damn shit is officially part of the subtitle, and the studio will email you if you don't put that in your review.
This is a gritty Nutcracker reboot? Is that what you're sounding like here?
It's not that gritty. I mean, how gritty can it be when guess who plays Strossmayer? Come on, just close your eyes and guess if you don't know. Who's going to play the...
Max von Sydow?
That's a pretty good guess. No, Morgan Freeman obviously has to play Strossmayer.
What?
So... right. So he's playing God. Anyways, it's a it tries to take Clara and turn her into some thing. It's not good. You don't believe it for a second. But
why didn't the Spice Girls remake The Nutcracker?
Well, Keira Knightley does make an appearance and is I don't want to spoil the whole thing, but.
Wait, anyway, does she turn into a zombie?
Victoria Beckham was in Bend It Like Beckham.
There was a moment in the movie when I got goosebumps and a swell of emotion, and it was the moment when it only happened for about 30 seconds. They actually just played the Nutcracker, so like they had the music and like the people dancing, and it was nice, and it makes you realize, wow, the Nutcracker is great. It's super great. And I went home and listened to The Nutcracker and I got all the emotions and feels. What a wonderful piece of art. Stop making garbage movies. The Nutcracker is great. And that is the end of the memo.
It needed zombies. Sounds like it needed zombies.
It kind of does have it's zombies. Like the, I mean, there's zombies. Like enslaved mouse monsters.
Do they do like a techno breakdown dance at any point in the movie or...
No, there's no dance off. Sadly,
that would have been so great.
If there had been, that would have just immediately 180 pivoted me, and I would have been like, "I'm going to see it right now."
Step up to the Nutcracker.
Bring it on, Nutcracker edition.
You know, this content is free, people. Right? Yeah. Like all you studio directors out, all you Netflix.
So, Catherine, if you had a Nazi Nutcracker dance off movie,
yes, would go.
Okay.
In a castle.
Thank you. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Goodbye.